From WIPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. The deadline to sign up for health insurance under Obamacare is Sunday night. We take a step back from the sign-up rush to explore how the Affordable Care Act is affecting doctors and patients. Then, how is something as tangible as our sense of touch connected to something as intangible as our emotions? Johns Hopkins neuroscientist David Linden explores just that question in his new book, Touch, The Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. He talks about it with Tom Hall. Plus, the history of Baltimore's Fells Point neighborhood stretches back more than 300 years. Donna Hawley, an adjunct professor of history at Sojourner Douglas College in Baltimore, tells us about the African-American-owned businesses and churches that began there. First, today's news.
I'm producer Matt Purdy. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Welcome back to Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. The deadline to sign up for health insurance runs through this Sunday, midnight, end of Sunday. As of last week, a total of 211,000 people had signed up for coverage this year in Maryland. Unlike last year, this year the state's online insurance marketplace has worked successfully. 5 years after the first provisions of the Affordable Care Act were enacted, today we're asking, how is the ACA working in Maryland? With us by phone to talk about it is Brendan Saloner. He's an assistant professor of health policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And I should say, you're in California, right? You're up real early to talk to us. I appreciate that.
I am, because I'm so excited to talk about health reform today.
Okay. With us in studio is Gene Ransom, Chief Executive Officer of the Maryland State Medical Society, MedCAI. Thanks for coming in.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Brendan Saloner, one of the main goals of the Affordable Care Act is to increase the number of people with health insurance in the U.S. Here in Maryland, as I mentioned, about 211,000 people have signed up for health insurance so far this year. One big question is the cost of health insurance. How has the ACA affected how much people pay for health insurance?
It's a great question. For consumers, the cost of health insurance has gone down, especially if they are eligible for subsidies, which many are, through the online marketplaces in the Affordable Care Act. So nationally, if you look at the data on what consumers are paying, consumers are reporting a decrease in their out-of-pocket spending, which is good news.
But is most of that because of the government subsidies, or is insurance actually costing less?
Well, what I'm referring to is the cost of insurance after subsidies. Mm-hmm. The cost of premiums, just overall, without factoring in subsidies, are increasing in all insurance markets, but the growth of insurance premiums has been actually relatively low in the last few years.
And do you have any sense of whether Maryland is on trend nationally with that?
Maryland looks pretty typical from the data that I've seen. Some of the plans are actually going down in the non-group market. So this year, the Kaiser plans actually are a little bit less expensive than they were. Some of the plans have gone up. So it's a mixed picture. On average, the premiums in Maryland have been increasing, but they're not too far out of the national norm.
Gene Ransom, let's talk about doctors. Are doctors seeing more patients with insurance as a result of the Affordable Care Act?
Yes, they definitely are. There are really two factors with regards to that. There was the Medicaid increase that was part of ACA, and there are a lot more Medicaid folks in Maryland. There's about 400,000 new Medicaid patients on the rolls that really is related to ACA activity. And the exchange is a little different for us because the Maryland rollout was so bad in the first year. So few people ended up with private insurance. Doctors haven't seen the full impact of the health insurance exchange, although they're beginning to see that now, and we're beginning to have effects from the exchange, the new patients in the exchange.
Give me a brief sense of the impact on doctors, the difference between seeing new Medicaid patients and new
private
The biggest concern from the insurance exchange is, well, let's say there's one thing that's positive. Maryland actually made the plans match the private market pretty closely. So some of the other issues we're hearing about in other states, like network adequacy and some other things, are not quite as bad in Maryland as we are hearing in other states. And that's a positive. One of the things that doctors are starting to see, they're very concerned about, is in the insurance exchange, particularly in like the bronze plan, the deductibles are very high. So it shifts risk to patient. There's a lot of patients. There's also something called the 90-day rule, which essentially shifts risk to hospitals and doctors after the first 30 days if the patient doesn't pay the premium. And when you're shifting risk away from the insurance companies into patients, they make decisions differently. We've heard anecdotes from physicians who said patients are making decisions not to get tests or procedures done because their deductible hasn't been met, and they're waiting to see if that's going to change later on in the year. And that's something that's very troubling.
Let me ask you about the cuts to Medicaid that former Governor O'Malley initiated in the fall. Governor Larry Hogan plans to continue. How do those cuts change the equation as to whether a doctor accepts a new Medicaid patient?
That's a major factor. So there, really, the ACA kind of did three things, if you simplify it. One was they set up the insurance exchange. The second thing was they did some insurance reforms. And the third thing was they came up with a plan to expand Medicaid. And in Maryland, we went full bore with the Medicaid expansion. Most of the folks who were signing up people for insurance ended up signing them up in Medicaid, and we ended up with close to 400,000 new Medicaid enrollees during this period. One of the reasons physicians were so willing to see these new patients is because, as part of the ACA in Maryland, we increased payment for primary care services for something called evaluation and management codes, and we said we're going to pay doctors the same for Medicaid as we do for Medicare. So doctors would get paid for Medicaid patients exactly as they do for Medicare patients. Governor O'Malley, on the way out the door, cut those rates down to 87% of Medicare. And obviously, Medicaid patients can be much more complex than a fully insured patient with a private plan or a Medicare patient. So when you pay people less to do what they could do in the other marketplace, for more, less doctors are going to be willing to take it. They're going to close their panels, and those kind of decisions are going to be made, and it creates access problems.
And that's what you're seeing?
Yes,
among your doctors.
Definitely. We're hearing from physicians that they're going to be doing things like closing their panels, seeing less Medicaid patients. And the problem with that is that shifts those patients into more expensive places, like the emergency room and other places where they get the care that ironically ends up in the long run costing the system more money. The best place for folks to get their care is in that primary care office. It's the best care. It's less expensive, and more preventative measures can be given. So we were really disappointed with Governor O'Malley and his cuts to the physician community, which really are going to hurt poor people.
On WIPR, this is Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass, speaking with Gene Ransom, CEO of the Maryland State Medical Society, MedCHI. And with us by phone is Brendan Saloner, an assistant professor of health policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. We're talking about how the Affordable Care Act is changing health care in Maryland. Brendan Saloner, how do we know yet if people have found a health care provider?
It's going to take a little bit of time. So if folks signed up for coverage in 2014, then some of them still haven't fully established care with the provider. The data that we have available right now suggests that there's been a slight uptick in people actually going to see primary care providers. It hasn't been anything too dramatic. There's been a decrease in the number of people who say that they have some kind of unmet health care need, which is also a positive that we think is connected to the Affordable Care Act. But the reality is that there's going to be a couple of years where there's going to be a slow take-up in folks actually getting into care with a primary care provider.
There's a recent report from the Maryland Parity Project that found in the area of mental health, less than half the psychiatrists in the networks offered by qualified health plans were actually reachable, only 43%. Many of the phone numbers and the addresses were wrong. Some listed weren't even psychiatrists. Brendan, does this problem extend beyond the mental health area?
It does. There's a general issue that needs to be ironed out with making sure that when people sign up for health insurance that they know which doctors are in their network. And the problem for that is multifaceted, but one of the issues is that The insurers have not been responsive in making sure that their new enrollees have up-to-date and accurate information on which doctors are in their networks. And that can be very frustrating for consumers because, as you can imagine, if you think that a doctor is going to take your insurance, then you call up and they either say, no, we're not, or you can't get accurate information, that can be a source of discouragement. So one of the changes that I'd like to see is better access to this kind of information for consumers.
Gene Ransom, I want to pull you into that, but first I want us to hear from Carmela Coyle. Producer Matt Purdy spoke yesterday with Carmela Coyle, who is CEO of the Maryland Hospital Association, to get a sense of what hospitals are seeing with the Affordable Care Act. Here's part of what she told us.
People now have health care coverage, but the state, in exchange, has reduced payments to hospitals that they used to receive for treating people who didn't have health insurance coverage. So financially, it's a wash. The real difference for hospitals is we now have these, you know, hundreds of thousands of people who previously only had access to a hospital emergency department, and now they have access to a primary care provider and skilled nursing facility care and home health nurses.
So this reference that Carmela makes to access to a primary care provider, it's been an ongoing issue in Maryland. Gene, what are you seeing? Are there enough primary care providers?
No, there are not. There are not enough primary care physicians. And everybody should have a primary care physician that they see and that they're getting care from. And I think another issue is there needs to be stronger laws and regulations around network adequacy. Insurers and in the Medicaid market, MCOs, managed care organizations, do not have enough rules around requiring them to have adequate networks. And that's something that we're going to support legislatively and regulatorily, that we put more restrictions on insurance companies so they're required to have adequate networks so patients really get care from a real physician. The other issue that was brought up was the idea of transparency. One of the other problems we're seeing is patients are not able to make good decisions when they're signing up because it's so confusing. And having the website be more transparent and easier for them to understand if a drug they're taking is in the plan and covered or if a doctor's in network would be an incredible asset for patients as they're making these decisions.
Brandon, we're almost out of time, but I just wanted to ask you briefly, one of the provisions that's been in place longest is the one that allows people under age 26 to stay on their parents' plan until they're 26. Are you how is that working? Briefly.
Sure, it's working really well. That provision went into effect in 2010. It still is very much in force. It's effective, and it basically means that young adults under the age of 26 are able to remain on their parents' health insurance coverage. And from my work and from the work of my colleagues, we're seeing that that provision has had a dramatic effect in increasing access to general health services, to mental health services, to hospital services, to all the kinds of care that
Brandon, we're up against the news. We have to leave it there. I want to thank you, Brendan Saloner, Assistant Professor of Health Policy at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Here with me is Gene Ransom, CEO of the Maryland State Medical Society. Thank you both.
Thank you so much.
Stay with
us.
You. On 88.1.
Is there an issue in Maryland that you'd like to see us cover? Let us know. You can email us at mdmorning@wypr.org. Or you can leave us a voicemail. Just call 410-881-3162. Now, back to the show.
And good morning, everybody. Glad you're with us on 88.1. It's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. David Linden is my guest this morning. He's a neuroscientist at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine and the former editor of the Journal of Neurophysiology. But take care here. If you're a little science phobic like me, don't let David's impressive resume scare you off. David actually writes books that even I can understand. And trust me, when it comes to science, that's saying something. His first book, The Accidental Mind, explored how our brains evolved over time to make us capable of things like romantic love and belief in God. In a book called The Compass of Pleasure, he argues that we are hardwired to seek pleasure in a variety of forms. And in both of those books, he writes about the inextricable link between our minds and our hearts. parts. Well, he's just published a new book in which he takes up the subject of touch. And again, he proposes that many of the ways in which we experience touch, from a tender caress to a painful injury, are all tied in one way or another to our emotions. The book is called Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. It's a fun and fascinating read. And a note to listeners with children nearby, we will be talking a little bit about sex. Good morning, David. Good to see you.
Thanks for having me on.
And welcome back. So you start right at the beginning of the book proposing a thought of if we had a sense that we chose to lose, if we had to lose one, we perhaps wouldn't think of how important touch is when we think of, you know, taste and smell and hearing and stuff. But it's more important than we think. It's actually it's not even optional for us in terms of human development.
That's right. I think we tend to discount touch because we can't imagine it not being there. We can close our eyes and imagine being blind, and we can plug our ears and imagine being deaf, and we can pinch our nose shut, but you can't turn off your touch sense. And it's true. So if a child is born blind, they can develop and have a normal mind, normal brain, normal body. Same if you're born deaf, you can have a great life. But if you're born with a sense of touch, but you are deprived of loving touch as a newborn and a toddler, as happened in Romanian orphanages in the 1980s and 90s, well, then a complete disaster unfolds.
Yeah, they actually have physical symptoms later in life. I mean, they have gastrointestinal problems, and they have psychological developmental problems. I mean, it's really severe, isn't it? Yeah,
it's quite severe, and the bad news is that it doesn't go away as you grow up. So these kids who didn't receive loving touch early in life, they develop self-soothing, compulsive rocking motions and attachment disorders. Their growth is slowed. Their cognitive development is reduced. But then, as adults, when we track them, they have high incidences of obesity, schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive. Disorder, immune system dysfunction. Touch is not optional for early human development the way the other senses are.
And it's interesting, you observe that metaphors about touch really pervade our rhetoric. We talk about, you know, being touched by her kindness, or he rubs me the wrong way. I mean, we have these phrases that actually, you know, relate directly to what things feel like on our skin.
Well, that's right. And we're so used to using them, we don't even think about them as having to do with touch at all. When we say my feelings to mean my tender emotions, there is a reason why it's my feelings and not my sightings or my smellings. I mean, this seems silly. And it seems, I think some of your listeners might say, well, but this is just a trick of modern day English. Who really cares that at this moment in time, in this one language, we happen to use that metaphor? But it's not just a trick of modern day English. And English, it's been around as long as we have recorded English, back to the 13th century. And we know that the constructions like I'm touched or my feelings are present in many languages, not just languages even of the Indo-European language group.
David Linden, the new book is called Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. I'm Tom Hall on 88.1. You're listening to Maryland Morning with Sheila Cast. So you talk about touch being intrinsically emotional. What does that mean?
Well, what it means, and this is a rather remarkable discovery, it turns out that if we look in our brains, we have two different streams of information coming from all the touch receptors, which are different kinds of nerve endings in our skin, some for heat and cold and pain and itch and vibration and texture and all these different things. And they go to our brain, and then we have two centers. One of them is there to just give us the facts of touch. Where on my body am I being touched? In what fashion? How intensely? And there's a completely separate region of the brain called the posterior insula that's involved in giving touch its emotional tone. It's what makes pain feel emotionally bad. It's what makes a caress or an orgasm feel emotionally good. And we think of these things as being intrinsic properties of pain or caress or orgasm. But that's just a trick our brain plays on us by having the fact analysis and the emotional analysis of touch happening at the same time.
So you say that all sensations, including touch, are in the service of action. Right? So they're not reporting on the outside world, but they're making inferences about what to expect from the outside world.
That's right. So our senses are not built to give us the lowdown. They're not built to give us the most accurate representation of the external world at all. As a result of our human experience and as a result of lots of evolutionary history, our senses cherry pick the data from the outside world to feed to us. Then, before we are ever conscious of it, they blend it with expectations about how the world works and with our emotions. So there is no sensation without emotion. Let me give you an example, right? If you like tea and you like coffee, and you pick up your mug and you're expecting coffee and you get a sip of tea, your experience of that at that moment is very, very different than if you were expecting tea and you got tea.
Yeah. And this business of the outside world and the touch that we experience from outside and the touch that we experience that's self-generated is interesting. We can't tickle ourselves. And self-inflicted pain is somehow less painful than pain inflicted by somebody else. Why is that?
Well, it's part of a general theme. In our brains, we're hardwired to discount sensations that result from our own movements, our own actions. And it happens in all senses. But just imagine walking down the street. You're walking down the street, you're swinging your limbs, and your clothes are moving against your body, but you don't even think about that. You don't even notice it. Yet, if you were still and then your clothes moved against your body in that same way, suddenly you would be saying, oh, who's groping me? What's going on? You'd be very attentive to it. And so when you go to tickle yourself, your brain is sending commands to the muscles in your arm and in your fingers to make the tickling motion. But a copy of that command is also going to the part of the brain called the cerebellum. And from there, it is inhibiting the part of your brain that feels the touch sensation and damping it down. And that damping is why we can't tickle ourselves unless you have damage to your cerebellum, which interrupts that dampening circuit.
And you talk about some cases in which that is the case, and in which patients report that. Yeah.
Right. It can happen with cerebellar damage. It can also happen in a subset of schizophrenics as well,
yeah,
possibly also because of cerebellar damage.
And all the sensations, including touch, are interrelated, right? So touch is just as interrelated to the others. I mean, you talk about how the context of touch really matters. I mean, if someone gives you a shoulder squeeze, if that's your boss coming up behind you in your cubicle, that's one thing. If it's your lover, you know, at dinner, that's another thing. So the context, the social context of how and by whom we're touched matters a lot.
Oh, it matters enormously. And I think the important thing to realize, imagine this, do this mental exercise. You're with your sweetheart, you're feeling good, connected, loving, and your sweetheart puts his or her arm around you and gives you a squeeze. Now imagine the very same squeeze from the very same person, identical, the same place on your skin, the same pressure, but now it's in the middle of an argument and it's not resolved. Well, that feels totally differently. And it's not just that it feels the same, but then you think about it differently, it actually feels differently. And the reason it does is because the higher areas of the brain that are involved in computing social context are sending messages to the somatosensory cortex, the part of the brain that actually creates the feeling, and changing that.
So the fourth chapter of the book is called Sexual Touch. And I'll admit, David, you had me at sexual. You did.
Mm-hmm.
So let's talk a little bit about the hard wire that we all have and then how that can perhaps even dictate our preferences in bed. You quote Naomi Wolf from a book she wrote called Vagina, A Cultural History. Is it true that we are sort of hardwired, our preferences in bed are somewhat hardwired and predetermined?
In truth, we don't know. So Naomi Wolf made a hypothesis, which is a reasonable one, and she pointed out that if you look at autopsy tissue, for example, of women, you find that the innervation of the genitals is not precisely the same from woman to woman. Some women might have a few more fibers in their clitoris and less in their cervix, some more in their labia, some more in their vagina, some more around the anus or the rectum. And so she hypothesizes, and this is a reasonable guess, maybe that variation has something to do with people's individual sexual likes and dislikes, and could be the same for men, who also aren't precisely hardwired in that innervation. But the truth is we don't know. And the reason is because these nerves are very small. They're they're too small for medical scanning machines. And so we can't just interview people about what they like in bed and then take a picture of their genitals and see how it correlates. We have cadavers, and most of the time we don't have interviews with people before they died asking what they liked in bed. So it's a reasonable guess. I think it's almost certain that a large aspect of people's sexual likes and dislikes are not heritable and not anatomical. It's an open question whether a part of it is.
How about broadly speaking, men and women? Do we experience touch differently?
We experience touch a little bit differently. If you're talking about sexual touch, it's actually remarkable how similar it is. So there was this great study where they asked men and women to write descriptions of their orgasms. And then people were hired to take out all the, you know, words like penis and vagina that would give away whether it was a man or a woman. And then these descriptions were given to people to read, students or doctors or psychologists, sex therapists. Nobody could tell the difference between which was a male and which was a female orgasm. And the same thing is true if you do brain scanning. If you do brain scanning in men and women while they're having an orgasm, they're only very subtle differences that you find. The pattern of activation is remarkably similar.
I really don't want to ask you how one does brain scanning of people while they're having an orgasm. Are there in fact studies that have happened like that?
Well, you know, not surprisingly, most of these studies are done in the Netherlands.
I see.
And
leave it to them.
It's a deeply unsexy situation.
One would imagine.
You know, your head, you have to think about it. Your head is strapped down because your brain can't jiggle. You have an IV in your arm to inject the radioactive water. You have a probe in your thuchus. It's not a romantic scene at all. And then there's some geek like me in a white coat with a clipboard staring at you.
Yeah, just in time for Valentine's Day, ladies and gentlemen, a new idea. You talk about how social touch reinforces cooperation and loyalty. I'm fascinated by a study they did with the National Basketball Association, finding that players who do celebratory touches, you know, chest bumps and stuff, early in the season, actually that's associated with higher win streaks and, win percentages later in the season. That's interesting.
Yeah, that's great. So this was a terrific study done at Berkeley by Dr. Keltner's group. And they got people to score all these NBA games. And it's just as you said, where there was more, they scored the butt pats and the high fives and the chest bumps and the high tens and all the things that people do to celebrate. And they found not only did the teams that celebrated more early in the season do better later, but when you analyzed their play, they played in a more team-like manner. In other words, a player who might have a poor shot but a chance at it would be more likely to pass off to his teammate who had a better shot rather than hogging the glory for themselves.
You talk about the emotional component of pain, and you talk about a disorder in which people are what's called pain asymbolic, where they don't have an emotional resonance with pain, and that can actually lead to all sorts of problems. And we're running out of time, but is there a way to attenuate pain? Is there a way to lessen one's sense of pain?
Well, you can, for chronic pain, you can lessen it with obviously with drugs, but more interestingly with practices like open presence meditation. There's a positive feedback loop between chronic pain and anxiety. And if you can break that loop with processes that reduce anxiety, both pharmacologic and behavioral, then you can do a lot of good.
Yeah, well, it's fascinating stuff. Thanks for coming in. Appreciate it, as always.
Thanks for having me on. It was fun.
David Linden's latest book, it's called Touch, the Science of Hand, Heart, and Mind. He'll be speaking about the book tonight, 7 o'clock at the Ivy Bookshop on Falls Road in North Baltimore. We've got a link to all the details at WIPR.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Coming up after a break for the news, excuse me, Sheila talks about African-American history in Fells Point. So stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning, and make a comment. We would love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. Again, that's all at wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. When you think of the history of Baltimore's Fells Point neighborhood, maybe you think first of privateers and pirates, but it wasn't only privateers who were making a living from the waters around Fells Point. The first black-owned shipyard and railway company was founded there nearly 149 years ago as a co-op. Donna Holly, adjunct professor of history at Sojourner Douglas College in Baltimore, will explore the contributions African Americans have made to Fells Point's history Friday at noon at City Hall. And today, she joins us to talk about it. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
Isaac Myers, a free black man born in Baltimore in 1835, was one of the founders of the Chesapeake Marine Railway and Dry Dock Company. It was the first such company owned by African Americans. It was cooperatively owned. Tell me about it.
It grew out of the fact that there was increasing competition from Irish immigrants for work on the docks. And many people who had been habitually hiring African Americans decided to hire the Irish people because they could pay them a lesser wage. So Isaac Myers, along with John Locks and about 12 other members of Bethel AME Church and Sharp Street United Methodist Church, decided to form their own company so that they could control hiring practices for their people. To their credit, they didn't just hire African Americans. They hired anybody who was willing to work. And at one point had negotiated a salary of $3 a day, which was a lot of money at that time.
Was it difficult for a group of African Americans to accumulate the capital to start a co-op business?
I don't think it was easy, but I think because of the networks and the cooperation that they had been used to experiencing as a community in the Fells Point area, it was a little bit easier than it may have been, say, like in a community like New Orleans, where people were stratified by caste and race and slave or free status. But you had a history of black people working collectively, in Fells Point. And so they were able to sell stock to members of their churches. And in fact, the first person to purchase stock was Frederick Douglass, who also grew up in Fells Point.
He was the first person to purchase stock in this company.
Yes, he was. He had been a childhood friend of John Locke's. And when they began to raise funds, Locke's contacted Douglass and he purchased stock.
Was Frederick Douglass active in investing in other African-American businesses?
You know, I really don't know. I just know about his political activities, his literary efforts, that kind of thing.
Was it difficult for the Chesapeake Marine Railway and Dry Dock Company to get business, to get contracts?
Apparently not. Both Locks and Myers had worked and had risen to levels of leadership in other marine and dry dock companies in the area. So they had the skill, they had the expertise, they had reputation that enabled them to get contracts. In fact, I think they did very, very well. They retired their debt in less than 10 years.
Now, was this part of a larger black labor union movement?
I don't believe so. I don't believe so. This was peculiar to the time and place.
You mentioned the role of some churches in that company's history. Fells Point was the birthplace of several important African-American churches in Baltimore that are now on Baltimore's west side. How did they get their start in Fells Point?
They grew out of Lovely Lane Methodist Church, which was originally in Fells Point and is now on 22nd Street in St. Paul. There were several African-American members of that church, as well as other churches. But the people in Fells Point who attended Lovely Lane decided at some point that they would leave and they would join a church called Strawberry Alley Methodist Church. Among the members there was Frederick Douglass.
Strawberry Alley is in Fells Point?
Yes, the street name has changed. I can't remember if it's Durham Street now, but there were a lot of alley streets in Fells Point. At any rate, people left Strawberry Alley and started Sharp Street United Methodist Church. I'm sorry, not United, just Methodist Church in Fells Point.
Sharp Street Methodist Church.
Exactly. Around the time that people in Philadelphia were breaking away from the Methodist Church and starting the African Methodist Episcopal denomination, that feeling spread to Baltimore because at that time, people, even though they were members, they would have to sit in the back of the church or they had to take communion after the white people took communion. So people left Sharp Street Church and started Bethel African Methodist Church. So all of them came out of Lovely Lane and the membership that they had.
And some of the churches moved to West Baltimore because?
I think probably because land was available. Sharp Street moved once or twice within the Fells Point and then the East Baltimore area. And then subsequently they were able to acquire a building that had been an Episcopal church in West Baltimore, and that's where they are today.
That's Donna Holly, adjunct professor of history at Sojourner Douglas College in Baltimore, here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about some of the ways Fells Point's history was shaped by African Americans. In the decade or so preceding the Civil War, Baltimore had the largest number of free blacks in the country. The 1850 census counted more than eight times as many free blacks as slaves. By 1860, the ratio was 11 to 1. With greater number, greater influence in the community, how did these black institutions, the churches, the businesses, work to end slavery?
They were very, very active in the formal abolitionist movement. In fact, Lovely Lane hosted several abolitionist conferences, one attended by Elisha Tyson, for whom Tyson Street is named, and the other attended by Richard Allen, who founded the African Methodist Episcopal denomination. So they had formal anti-slavery organizations. In addition, because the population was so varied in terms of race, in terms of language, in terms of country of origin, if you were a freedom seeker running away, it was easy to hide in Fells Point. So you had these informal networks, including Underground Railroad activities. A recent historical study has indicated that Harriet Tubman spent time in Fells Point when she was raising money to finance her expeditions to the Eastern Shore, and in fact had helped her sister and her sister's child escape to be with her husband, the sister's husband, in Fells Point.
What inspired you to look into Fells Point's history?
Actually, I started with genealogy. My aunt married into the family of John Locks. And as a child, I was always fascinated because my father was a steel worker and my Uncle Joe was a businessman. And I wondered, why was it that he was able to work for himself and not have to, like most of the men I knew, work for somebody else? So I began to do a genealogical study on my Uncle Joe's family, and that's when I discovered John Locks. And as I looked more into him, I realized he was part of a community, a network, that was working actively to uplift black people in terms of education, employment, spirituality, in every political activities. All this was going on, but it all came out of my interest in my Uncle Joe.
I really appreciate your talking to us about it. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Donna Holly, adjunct professor of history at Sojourner Douglas College in Baltimore. She'll be speaking at Baltimore City Hall Friday from noon to 1. We have links to those details at our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
We have production help from
Estelle Klein
and Catherine Sway.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. On this day in Maryland history, 1971, Sterling Keyes became the first African-American superintendent to lead Baltimore City Public Schools. It was an interim position. He was in the job for 6 months. Thanks for listening. We're back on Friday. Please tune in.